Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 17th of February. This hour of the program, Michael Cooper is joining us, reporter for the New York Times, who's done some great work lately on what's happening with the stimulus package that the president will sign today in Denver. In a piece maybe you saw in the New York Times Week in Review section on Sunday, he says from a public works perspective, the $789 billion stimulus package is unlikely to transform the physical fabric of the nation as the New Deal did when it built hundreds of airports, tens of thousands of bridges, and hundreds of thousands of buildings and miles of roads. The final plan devotes more than $100 billion to public works projects, but that is only a fraction of the $2.2 trillion that the American Society of Civil Engineers says is needed to put the nation's infrastructure into a state of good repair. That's our subject this hour, the infrastructure and the stimulus bill. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we do want to remind you that Senator George McGovern, who had to cancel last week because he was on an airplane, will be with us the second hour of our program today to talk about Abraham Lincoln. So it should be a good 2 hours. Michael, thank you very much for joining us. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. You know, this is an amazing amount of money that the American Society of Civil Engineers says that we need. $2.2 trillion, and $100 billion sounds like a lot, but not to the Society of Civil Engineers, huh?
It really is eye-opening. And, you know, granted, civil engineers maybe have a little bit of a vested interest in getting more money spent on infrastructure, since much of those jobs would go to civil engineers. But if you look at the reports they've been doing for several years now, they really identify a lot of big needs, whether it's the many bridges that are deemed insufficient, you know, the crumbling roadways. This year, I think for the first time, they took a look at levees, which is, you know, a hot topic since New Orleans, and determined that there are hundreds of billions of dollars of needs there. So they really took a look at what's happened in the country and determined that a lot more investment needs to be done to keep up our infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And then you look at what's going on in California. They're laying off 20,000 workers, and also their plan halting all remaining public works programs in the whole state.
Right. And this is happening throughout the country, which is another red flag that goes up with this, the federal stimulus package. I mean, granted, $100 billion is going to be a very welcome injection of cash to states across the country to get road projects going, but lots of states have halted their projects because they don't have the money from their own end. Either they can't raise the money because they can't sell the bonds they need, or they just don't have the local part of the money to make it happen. So in lots of cases, I think there are going to be lots of states that have projects on the books that they'd hope to do themselves that they weren't able to do, and now they'll just use federal money to do projects that they'd hope to do anyway on the state level.
And Michael, what's the plan here? Will the money go directly to states and they'll decide whether or not to build a bridge or to make a road better? How's this going to happen?
Well, there are different pots of money in the bill, but for the bulk of the transportation and transit money, it'll be sent out the same way they send out transportation money every year. There are sort of complicated formulas that after years of wrangling and fighting and politicking in Washington, they've worked out. And so a lot of that money will go directly to states, and the states will then have a lot of latitude in deciding what kinds of programs they want. That's a mixed blessing, though. I mean, I guess if you're a governor, you like that, or if you're, you know, a transportation or highway cabinet member of a state, you like that. But it's not necessarily the best way to sort of set big national priorities and decide, you know, what should the federal government be spending its money? What kinds of big grand dreams can we make happen? Because what ends up happening is the money gets diffused very quickly. I mean, you know, $100 billion sent out to 50 states. Each state has its own needs, different regions of the state. So if everybody gets a little bit, there isn't an easy way for a few big projects to get a lot.
Mm-hmm. Compare this with the New Deal, which you did in your article on Sunday in the New York Times. They built airports, bridges, thousands of them. Spent a lot more money?
Yes. I mean, I haven't looked at the dollars then versus the dollars now, but I can tell you there's almost no way it would be possible for this package to do a New Deal scale of building. I mean, think about this. They built 650,000 miles of road. They built 78,000 bridges, 125,000 buildings. Some of them were civilian buildings and city halls and courts. Some of them were military buildings. They built or improved 800 airports and, you know, paved 700 miles of airport runways. I mean, this was, you know, a mammoth undertaking that really transformed kind of the physical fabric of the nation. Now, I think what most states will do, because there are kind of restrictions placed upon how you can spend this money, and one of the main priorities now is getting the money spent quickly, I think you're going to see a lot of highway repaving projects, bridge painting projects. They're going to do some things, a lot of maintenance, which is certainly needed and probably a wise thing to do, but I doubt you're going to see the kind of new mega projects built that you saw in the New Deal.
So this idea of green transportation, high-speed rail, et cetera, will be off the table?
Well, no. The Senate actually put in $8 billion for high-speed rail, which, again, sounds like a lot of money, but it's probably not enough money to get a real high-speed rail line going anywhere in the country. You know, high-speed rail is common in the rest of the world. They've been doing it in Japan for 40 years now. You can take, you know, a high-speed train from Paris to London through the Channel Tunnel now. It's in all kinds of countries in Europe and Asia. China is building more. But we've never had real high-speed rail in the United States. The state that's probably closest now to making that a reality is California, where this past November there was a ballot measure that passed that authorized borrowing $10 billion to begin work on an 800-mile high-speed rail train line that would go from San Francisco to Los Angeles in about 2 hours and 40 minutes. But that project alone is estimated to cost $45 billion. So even with the $8 billion that is authorized in this bill, that's just sort of a small start, especially when you consider that there are 11 different regions in the country that are vying for their own high-speed rail lines. So what often happens with federal programs is, you know, a little bit will go to each region and nobody will have enough to actually make it come to fruition.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at jobs for a moment, Michael. Will there be a creation of, and can we put a number of them, a significant number of jobs as a result of the infrastructure part of this bill?
I think there's no doubt that there will be jobs because there are, you know, road crews, you know, all over the country that have been idle. Since this recession began in the housing sector, it's hit construction particularly hard. I mean, unemployment is up everywhere, but unemployment in the construction sector is worse than almost anything else. So, you know, just the transit, the highways and bridges money, which is about $29 billion in the bill, you know, in Washington, they estimate that that's going to translate into about 835,000 jobs. So that's a significant number when you consider that overall the $787 billion stimulus package was supposed to create between 3.5 and 4 million jobs. You know, 800,000 for road projects alone is a big chunk of that.
Mm-hmm. You outlined, it's really an interesting piece in the paper on Sunday, some of the, which I have in front of me here, some of the jobs or some of the areas that various states would like to deal with, California drinking water, a Hudson rail tunnel. Can you highlight a couple of those now and whether or not they'll be able to proceed, the most interesting to you?
Sure. And one of the things that I was doing was I was trying to show that even though very few transformative projects are likely to be built as a result of this package, that it's not because there's a lack of imagination or a lack of need in the country. I mean, all regions of the country have big plans, big dreams, big hopes. And, you know, what may be a missed opportunity about this package is that because it will get spread out across the country, it's doubtful that any of these will get very far alone based on this federal stimulus plan alone. So, for instance, you know, everybody hates flying these days. You know, airplane delays are just appalling. I covered the campaign for the last 2 years, and I can tell you from personal experience that I just spent an unbelievable amount of time sitting in airports around the country, waiting for hours, missing connections. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and this is a serious problem that could actually probably affect the commerce of the country if lots of people are missing their connections. So, this bill will have money for improving airports and maybe lengthening some runways and trying to add capacity. But what most people think needs to be done, and certainly what the FAA thinks needs to be done, is a complete overhaul of the air traffic control system. You know, what they want to do right now is scrap the system we have now that uses radars to track planes and beams the, you know, the planes' locations back to them and start going with a satellite-based system, sort of like GPS that so many people have in their cars now that's common, which is much better than what you probably would have if you were flying a commercial airplane. And so they want to have this satellite-based technology. It would probably cost between $15 and $22 billion over the next, you know, 15 or 20 years to make this happen. That's not going to get much further along because of this package. You know, this package will focus on the immediate needs of, you know, repaving a runway here or there that might tweak, you know, the problem, but it's not going to make a huge dent in the problem the way an overhaul of air traffic control would happen.
Mm-hmm. How about a bridge to Canada? You read your piece on this and you say, I can't believe we don't have one of these.
Right. Well, right now, I mean, I was just in Detroit a couple of weeks ago. You know, there are two crossings. There's a tunnel to Canada and there's, you know, an 80-year-old privately owned bridge.
Oh, my.
And so right now, the United States government and the Canadian government are working together on building a new public bridge from Canada that would be a couple of miles south from the existing one. It would be wider. I think they would feel happier having the bridge, you know, on a border crossing controlled by the government rather than by a private business person. And so, you know, this is the kind of project that might get some money, but it's going to be an expensive project. You know, the United States share of this is going to be well over $1 billion. And so if you're the state of Michigan, which has lots of pressing needs, you know, do you make sure that all of your roadways get into a state of good repair, or do you, you know, spend a lot of money jump-starting a new bridge to Canada? It's a tough question. And these are the kind of questions that, you know, state houses all across the country are going to need to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, similarly, I mean, there is quite a lot of money in this for infrastructure for water. I mean, you know, some people will tell you that some of the greatest public works in the country nobody thinks about because they're built and buried, and that those are the pipes that deliver your water and, you know, the sewage systems that get rid of the waste. All over the country, there are systems that were put in place 50, 100 years ago, and they're near the end of their useful life. I mean, you know, water main breaks happen once in a while, and they sort of call attention to this. But absent, you know, a geyser shooting out of the middle of your street downtown or a sinkhole eating up a car, people tend to forget about that. So there is a lot of money for water in this. But, you know, what I did look at in this piece was, you know, the needs of the Southwest for water are amazing. I mean, mm-hmm. there's been a drought down there for a long time. You know, all of the states are fighting over their shares of the Colorado River. And, you know, what I chose to focus on was California, where a lot of officials there say that one of the major sources for water for 25 million people in California is at risk because there's a delta where the Sacramento and San Joaquin rivers meet.
Oh,
and it's protected, the area around it is protected by a bunch of levees that are more than 100 years old. And so there are lots of fears that if there was a powerful earthquake out there or if there are rising sea levels because of global warming, salt water could come cascading into this delta and basically contaminate what's a very important source of the water. So Governor Schwarzenegger had a task force recently look at it, and they determined that they would probably need to build an enormous new aqueduct to sort of bypass the whole Delta region and bring water from North California to the arid South. But this could cost tens of billions of dollars because you'd also have to, you know, fix up the Delta region. It's just a massive undertaking that nobody's really made a plan, so it's hard to put a price tag on. But it just shows that, you know, even though there are, I forget the exact amount in the bill, you know, $18 billion for water. If you look at the needs out there, especially in some regions, you know, it could easily exceed that without a problem.
Right. One more area, and then we'll go to phone calls. I didn't know this. You talk about the Chicago rail network, a quarter of the nation's rail freight rolling through Chicago. But the network is so snarled, it can sometimes take longer for freight trains to make it through Chicago than to reach Chicago from the West Coast in the first place.
Right. I mean, this is a system that was built over many years and sort of jerry-rigged and put together on the fly without lots of planning. So rail companies, you know, have been wanting to untangle and unsnarl the system for years. It wouldn't only help goods move faster, which would probably make them cheaper ultimately, but it would also free up some of the passenger rails, which, you know, people in Wisconsin might be interested to hear, because, you know, the snarl of freight trains can sometimes, you know, have an impact on what you could do with passenger trains. Again, this is a project that, you know, it would be invisible to most people because we rarely think, you know, where the goods we buy in the store come from. But it could make them cheaper if it takes a shorter time to get them across the country. But that's a $2.5 billion worth of projects of fixing grade crossings and modernizing track and untangling the system. And so, you know, it's a big need. It's been on the books for years. It may get some money, but it probably won't get enough money to do as much as they'd like to do.
Right. Let's go to phone calls for Michael Lim. We'll do that in a moment. Michael Cooper is our guest. He is a New York Times reporter and has done some very good work lately concerning the infrastructure and how the stimulus bill will take on problems with the infrastructure. Is it enough money? What's targeted? How will it be distributed? Will it create jobs? Is it just too little? to make a significant difference. Michael also covered, as you heard him say, he was stuck at a lot of airports all around the country because he covered the presidential campaign as well. Our phone number, our lines are busy right now, but there will be an opening down the road here. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Senator George McGovern joins us the second hour of the program today to talk about his new book, Abraham Lincoln. All right, let's go to phone calls now for Michael Cooper, New York Times reporter, and we start with Laverne from Monroe. Hi, Laverne.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
I used to be a Republican, and then I read a book about Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. He said we should have our federal income tax based on ability to pay. And when I read that, just that one comment, and I told my wife, isn't that a novel thought? And rich people, they love to hide their money, a lot of it in Switzerland. They say, and you look up on the web, 1% has 50% of the wealth. The middle class can't keep carrying this burden and borrowing from Social Security when the other half of the people, the wealthy people, are hoarding their money. And they don't want regulations. They just want more and more and more. They're going to eliminate the middle class unless we can get back in to the fact we should tax on ability to pay. What do you think, so or not?
Well, what I think doesn't matter, but I'll tell you that in this stimulus bill, there are a number of tax provisions that are partly aimed at easing some of the inequalities that have arisen in recent years with wealth. I mean, one of the main pieces of it is something that President Obama campaigned on, which is an income tax credit that he calls the Making Work Pay tax credit, which would be about up to $400 for individuals and $800 for couples. And it's really geared at, you know, lower middle and, you know, and middle class people. You know, you only get it if you're earning up to $75,000 if you're an individual, or up to $150,000 if you're a couple. And again, the idea here is, you know, a lot of Democrats felt that the Bush tax cuts, you know, unfairly favored the wealthiest people and gave the biggest cuts to the wealthiest individuals. And so part of President Obama's campaign, and now part of this bill that he's signing, is designed to be a tax cut that would go towards, you know, poorer and working and middle-class people, and that's that provision.
Would we? I guess I'm trying to figure out some way. Obviously, we're not going to get close to what the engineers want us to have, but a lot of people have said that we need a whole lot more money. Would there be a way to get more money if we change the tax structure and significantly increase taxes on people who make a lot, significantly increase corporate taxes? I'm wondering how we could get more money to do what needs to be done.
Yeah, it's a good question. Another thing that, you know, President Obama campaigned on was ending the Bush tax cut for the tax cuts for the wealthiest people. But I think he already has figured out what he wants to do with that money, and that money he'd like to devote in part, I believe, towards his plan to overhaul the healthcare system to make healthcare, you know, more widely available and more affordable, which will be an expensive plan in itself. So I'm not sure exactly what we're going to do. There are lots of ideas out there for how to get more money for this. I mean, people want, you know, they're not very popular with us users, but people want user fees, which means more tolls on bridges, more tolls on roads. Mm-hmm. There are plans, you know, to have what are called, you know, public-private partnerships, you know, where you would get a private company maybe to put up the money to build something, but then they would be able to collect the money on the tolls, and perhaps they would even, you know, maintain the structure. You know, this is controversial because, you know, sometimes the way they would try to save money maintaining a structure would be not to use union workers or not to use workers with the same protections as state workers. So this is the kind of thing that often leads to big fights. And there are also real questions about whether a private company should be in charge of something that's essentially a public good. I mean, there are always complications. Here in New York, where I am, you know, one of the things that's made it complicated to rebuild the World Trade Center since September 11th is the fact that, you know, only a few years before the attacks, it was transferred from being, you know, essentially a public building that, you know, run by a public authority, and it was leased to a private individual. And this made the rebuilding very complicated because suddenly you had somebody else at the table who said, you know, I signed a lease for this, and I want this many feet of office space, and I want, and it sort of constrained the public officials and what they could do when they were reimagining what to do with the site. So there are all kinds of philosophical questions too about what should be private and what should be public, and you know, there are arguments to be made that sometimes the private sector is more efficient at some of these things, and you're beginning to see projects creeping up around the state, you know, with privately held toll roads are increasingly common. But there are also problems, and you know, and right now the recession is highlighting some of these problems, because you know, private companies, as you know, aren't doing so well. So, you know, one of the projects I was looking at is there's been a dream in Miami for many years to build a tunnel to the port of Miami, which is on an island, and they want to have this tunnel because right now the trucks that go there have to kind of rumble through downtown, and it sort of creates traffic and gridlock, and it's a little unsightly if you're trying to develop the waterfront there. And they had a plan, they thought, to have a private-public partnership there, and they would have a private firm put up the money and make it happen. But just in this December, the state said they couldn't sign off on the deal because they didn't think their private partners had the money anymore to make this happen. And so you're seeing that happen in a number of areas where there are public-private partnerships, but the private sector is such a mess and the credit crisis is so severe that they just don't have the money right now.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Laverne, for your call. Let's go to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Another fine guest, and may I pose a question to him?
Of course.
Which is that, would he agree with Paul Krugman, his colleague Paul Krugman at the New York Times, given his own article, that the opportunity for a Keynesian stimulus of sufficient size has been missed, and that if the government was willing and the country was willing to spend the money on that Keynesian stimulus, it could go through the necessary round of what in the 19th century was called internal improvements, the type of thing that Lincoln was greatly concerned with, by the way. And that... Another point that Krugman makes, and I wonder if he would like to comment on it, is that we're not in a conventional recession, you know, where tax cuts actually are effective stimulus, but we're in a crisis that has to do with the insolvency of the banks, and that solving that problem is putting the finance system in order, recognizing that the banks are insolvent, and then opening institutions that can act as fiduciaries and provide credit is necessary. And it was the failure in Japan to do that, to allow zombie banks to exist for well over a decade, that explained the underperformance of Japan in the last 15 years. And we should not commit that error. And it would not that Japan spent money as a fiscal stimulus and engaged in infrastructure problems and failed, but that Japan did not deal with the problems of the financial system. Would the United States repeat that performance, or is it going to actually meet the magnitude of the problem? Thank you.
Thank you, Frank, so much.
It's a great question. Now, you know, I just so we're clear, you know, I'm a shoe leather, regular, old-fashioned reporter on the news side, so I don't, you know, I haven't earned my opining stripes yet like my colleague Paul Krugman.
One of these days.
But, but I will tell you that, you know, he's not alone. There are a number of economists who, as Frank said, you know, are worried that the size of this stimulus package is too small given the magnitude of the problem. And, you know, what happens in a downturn like this is, you know, the private sector is not spending the money. You know, people are losing their jobs. So the public sector has to step in and inject money into the economy. And that's the whole idea. Even with this $787 billion package, you know, the Congressional Budget Office still estimating that unemployment, which is already high, will continue to rise, which, you know, that's a little alarming for a lot of people to hear. The idea is that it wouldn't rise as much as it might have without this. So there are a number of economists, Paul Krugman included, who believe that, you know, a much bigger package is needed, much greater investment. You know, in fact, there's been a lot of talk these days about what is the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. You know, there have been some revisionist historians on the right questioning whether it worked so well, but there's also been a lot of economists and historians who have determined that, you know, the New Deal, the problem was not that it spent too much, but perhaps that it didn't spend enough. You know, there was a point, you know, a few years into the New Deal when Franklin Roosevelt decided that, you know, he really had to worry about balancing the budget, and so he pulled back on the spending and, you know, and tried to make the books balanced. And at that point, you know, what you had been seeing in terms of the beginning of the recovery slowed dramatically. And then suddenly, you know, you really needed World War II to pull the country out of the rest of it. So there really is a raging debate right now about whether $787 billion is sufficient. I mean, you'll hear lots of Republicans saying it's way too much. In fact, you know, it started out at, you know, $820 billion in the House, and it was really whittled down because they needed to get the votes of, you know, three moderate Republican senators. And, you know, so they pulled it all the way back to 787, but, you know, I heard one liberal economist saying that, you know, cutting the size of the stimulus package, you know, in his formulation, you know, was like taking a shortcut when you're jogging. You know, it's like it becomes a smaller route, but you don't get the benefits that you were looking for. So there is certainly a point of view, and the caller is absolutely right that the financial system part of this is hugely important, and this is why I think, In many ways, you know, what Tim Geithner comes up with, you know, at the Treasury is really going to be key as to, you know, how long this recession lasts and how well they pull out of it. Right. And you saw last week, you know, when he came out with his sort of formulation of principles, the market tanked because I think they had really hoped, you know, if you heard what traders were saying, that there would be a real plan, like a granular plan with lots of details. Instead, they heard sort of broad principles. And I think that scared them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you saw the market lose, you know, several hundred points of value that day.
When will we know and how will we know, Michael, whether or not $787 billion is the right amount?
We may not know for years. The other thing is, you know, perhaps if things continue to get worse rather than better, maybe they will go back to the well. Maybe they will. You heard some people speculating that perhaps a second stimulus would be needed at some point before the first one has even been signed.
Right.
So I think they're going to keep looking, you know, what happens to unemployment, you know, what happens to the safety net, what happens to tax collections. You know, if they feel like they're beginning to make a dent at these problems, then I think they'll think it's sufficient. You know, if things continue to get a lot worse before they get better, maybe they'll take another crack at it.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mike from Oshkosh. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. It's a little frustrating when you hear about, you know, this talk of a second stimulus and the stimulus isn't big enough. We've already handed to our kids about $56 trillion of debt. That's about $200,000 per person. Now, at some point, somebody's going to have to sit back and say they just can't possibly accept one more penny of debt. And, you know, the guest, you know, not to pick on him, but here we are talking about possibly a much larger stimulus to deal with our infrastructure. I agree we should address that, but I don't think we should be doing it on the backs of our kids. Now, right now, the fourth biggest program in government is interest payments on the debt. $400 billion a year we're spending on interest because of that debt that we don't have the courage to address. In 10 years, it's going to be $700 billion a year. And we're saying $100 billion for infrastructure is not enough. If we would somehow get the courage to deal with this debt, we could probably reinvest some of that money in infrastructure. And as the guest knows and Kathleen knows, medical payments, our medical system is crashing under its own weight. That is what's taking the oxygen out of the room. The Republicans, Democrats alike are going to have to get a national health care system, cut our health care costs in half, as we simply can't afford the interest payments and the medical costs in the future. It's really the only solution.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Michael?
I think, you know, he's absolutely right. I mean, at some point, the debt becomes so crushing that it crowds out future investment, and that's a serious problem that I think everybody agrees with. But what you've seen right now in the current downturn to a remarkable degree is that economists on the left and right alike have all come out for deficit spending, and they differ in the degree of deficit spending, the amount of deficit spending, but almost every one of them, including, you know, economists who advised John McCain in his campaign, have said that they think, you know, the government needs to spend money quickly, even if it means going into debt. Even people who are normally deficit hawks who want to see, you know, the deficit erased are saying that right now is not the time to do that. That said, there are real questions about how much it should be. Is 787 too much or too little? And, you know, and there's no doubt that down the road, when interest payments come due, it will constrain future leaders and what they can spend money on. I mean, I've also covered government at the local level here in New York and at the state level, and I can tell you that, you know, they have shockingly big budgets here. But if you talk to any mayor or any governor, they'll always tell you that there's relatively little that they can control because so much of the money goes to interest payments or, as the guest said, health care payments or, you know, pension payments, that, you know, the amount of discretionary money that they can really control and try to enact new policies with and fix new problems seems to be an ever smaller slice of the pie.
Right. Thanks, Mike, so much for your call. Judy from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I have been to several meetings since the president was elected from the change.gov site in Milwaukee, where the Obama administration has encouraged us to get together in house parties and talk about our goals for stimulus money and recovery. And at every one of the meetings, people have spoken about the need for jobs, especially green jobs, public transportation, and health care reform. And I wonder if you have come to any conclusions about which state is making the most creative use of, or is likely to, of the stimulus money based on those desires for green jobs and improved public transportation and health care reform. Mm.
Well, it's a little early to handicap how these states are doing because most states haven't come up with a definitive list as to how they're going to spend the money. They're all just beginning to figure out how much money they can expect, and now they're all going to begin the process of, you know, fighting over it and, you know, wrestling with their consciences of how to spend it best. There is some money in this. For transportation, I mean, there's $8.4 billion for transportation capital spending, but in a way, it's a lot of transit advocates came away very disappointed because that money is all going to be spent on repairs, you know, new rolling stock, which to you and I is new buses, new train cars, things like that, and, you know, capital improvements. The problem is that transit systems all across the country are, despite having record riderships, you know, once gas hit $4
yes.
a gallon, you know, lots of people began taking buses and trains who never took them before, and many systems found that even when gas got cheaper, some of the new riders stayed on. So all across the country, they're having record ridership, but all across the country, they're facing record budget shortfalls because I think most of your listeners know transit is paid only partly by, you know, your fares. It's also supported by tax revenues, and since there's a recession going on, the tax revenues that are coming in are lower. So even though trains and buses are more crowded than ever, lots of these systems are going to be cutting service, laying off workers. I recently went to St. Louis where they're going to, you know, eliminate all express bus service. They're going to stop service at 2,300 stops all around the city, cut almost half of bus service there. And it's going to be a big problem. I mean, I went to a nursing home in the suburb where lots of the nurses and housekeepers and cooks were going to have no way to get to their jobs.
Oh, my
gosh.
So
they were going to find, you know, even in a tough economy, they were going to find themselves maybe out of work if they can't find a way to go. And so there's no money in this bill for operating assistance. So, you know, while a place like St. Louis is going to be putting 165 buses into a garage, the bill will have money for other systems to buy new buses. It may help them in the long run, but it won't help people in the short run get through this problem.
And what's the specific problem in St. Louis, Michael? Why would they retire so many buses?
Well, because they just don't have the money. I mean, they, you know, right now the tax revenues are down. They had tried to have a ballot measure in November asking for, I think, another penny of sales tax to support transit, and it didn't pass. And so now, you know, unless they get a windfall, unless the state steps in and helps them, you know, they're going to need to scale back tremendously. And St. Louis is extreme, but by no means alone. I mean, New York City is looking at, you know, maybe a 25% fare increase. They're going to cut two subway lines. They're going to try and close some subways at night, which, you know, New York is a very much a 24-hour kind of place. And I don't know if you've been here, but even if you ride the subway at 2 in the morning, it's often quite crowded with people working night shifts and all kinds of things. Washington, D.C., which had a record day of metro ridership for the inauguration, you know, that more than a million people took the metro that day, is going to have to eliminate 900 positions and cut service. I mean, it pretty much across the board, large systems and small systems, they're all cutting service, they're all laying off people, they're all raising fares, and it's because the tax revenues they depend on are just aren't there right now.
And then they're going to have fewer tax revenues because people won't be able to get to work, so they can't pay their taxes because they won't be working.
A vicious circle, yes.
Right.
So that won't be in here. But there is, there's other money in here for green things. I mean, there's quite a lot of money that President Obama wanted that's going to make federal buildings more energy efficient, which, you know, A, it's something that could be spent quickly because the federal government controls its buildings and it can easily hire lots of people to weatherize them and make them energy efficient. And they say that down, you know, in the long run, that will save money on, you know, fuel and heating and electricity costs and things like that. And then there are other pots of money that are supposed to go towards creating a smart electric grid, which is a very complex issue. Almost everybody agrees it's needed, but it's very hard to spend that money because very few people want power lines in their areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are your thoughts about all of that, Judy?
I still want to know which state is likely to be most imaginative and creative.
Wisconsin, of course.
No, you haven't heard a thing in Wisconsin.
In 2 weeks when we see what the states are really going to be doing.
Yeah, I'm just being
facetious. I mean, you're talking about California, but that doesn't... And Governor Schwarzenegger, but are there any other governors with that kind of vision?
Actually, a lot of states have come to the forefront in recent years and when it comes to environmental vision. I mean, it was states like California and New York and others that, you know, tried to go beyond what the Federal Environmental Protection Agency was doing in terms of setting, you know, different standards for air quality and things like this. So I wouldn't be surprised, you know, I think a lot of them would like to do something. The question is, you know, these states, I mean, and California is in terrible. I mean, it's having a tremendous fiscal crisis right now. So it becomes balancing, you know, the forward-looking things they would like to do with just keeping afloat right now. And so, that, you know, there are real trade-offs involved.
Yeah.
Thanks, Judy.
Thank you.
We're going to take more phone calls in a moment. Michael Cooper is our guest this hour, a reporter for the New York Times, who's done a very interesting series of articles recently on the stimulus bill and what will happen with infrastructure in this country. What do we mean, we'll ask this question too, by shovel-ready projects? Are they ready to go all over the United States? What are those particular kinds of projects? And are they? Has everybody examined them? Would they be ready to go a couple of weeks from now? The bill will be signed today. What happens in the next couple of weeks? We are welcoming your calls at 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Senator George McGovern joins us the second hour of our program today to talk about Abraham Lincoln. Let me just give you this phrase, shovel-ready projects. And what comes to mind, Michael, when you hear that?
Well, that's actually sort of a new phrase that, you know, has only been around for a few years. There was a very interesting article in the Washington Post recently trying to trace the etymology of the phrase, and I think they traced it to a power company in upstate New York. But the idea is that for this stimulus to work, you have to get money coursing through the economy very quickly. And so, as you know, I'm sure, you know, nothing could move at a more glacial pace sometimes than big construction projects, especially when the government is involved. There are all levels of, you know, community review, environmental review, partisan wrangling. It can take forever to build some of these things. And they didn't want that to happen. They want the money going into workers' pockets pronto. So President Obama, you know, made this declaration that he wanted the money to be spent on shovel-ready projects. What that's probably going to mean is it's going to mean that the money has to go to projects that are already on the books, they're planned, they're ready to go, they've just been waiting for money. Most states have, you know, long lists of capital plans that they kind of do a little bit at a time when they have the money to do it. There's language in the bill that says, you know, for the highway and bridge money, for instance, which is about $29 billion. They want at least half of that money to be obligated by the states within 120 days. So they want things that are, which is one of the reasons that it will be much easier to do sort of small, lots of small projects than a few big projects. And there are pros and cons to both approaches. I mean, if you do lots of small projects, you get workers working, you know, covering more ground. So maybe you help lift the economy in more regions as they go for lunch in more parts of your state. On the other hand, a lot of those small projects may not pay dividends in the future by, you know, transforming something the way, you know, a new high-speed rail line might, you know, for instance, just hypothetically boost the economy in some region or make things really different in the long run. But that would take years of planning to really happen. So that's sort of the trade-off right there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, spending $787 billion quickly is not that easy. You know, it's a lot, in many cases, you know, federal departments are going to be, you know, forced to disperse more money than they do in their annual budgets. And, you know, they have to figure out how to get it out the door responsibly but quickly. And it's going to be a challenge.
And quickly is important in all of this, right? To see some kind of, for political reasons, to see, hey, this is working.
Not just for political reasons. I think there's this idea that, you know, in a downturn, if you can stave it quickly, you know, if you can put out the fire before the fire is, you know, engulfed everything, it's better than if you let it get a lot worse, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's go to Steve from Oshkosh next. Hi, Steve.
Hi. What about plans that are not yet shovel-ready, such as the mini projects in the city of Oshkosh's pedestrian and bicycle circulation plan? Will we get another chance to make them shovel-ready and qualify for funding? No, I understand that the president's overall goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And if we're not careful, we could lock in increased greenhouse gas emissions for decades to come if we fund infrastructure projects that, you know, promote more car dependence and such.
Right. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen in Oshkosh. I mean, I know that states will have a little bit of latitude if only half the money has to be obligated within 120 days, to me it sounds like they could have a little more flexibility with the other half of the money, although I think they would need to get it done pretty quickly. But your broader point about, you know, whether this plan works against the president's goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions is something that a lot of people are talking about and worried about. You know, the share going to highways and bridges, $29 billion, is, you know, more than three times as much as goes to, you know, mass transit, which is $8.4 billion. Now, how the states use that money is very important. And there are lots of, you know, transit advocates and environmental advocates that are calling on states to think carefully about how they spend that money so that they won't be making problems worse. They don't want states building a new highway to an exurb that's ever further out that will, you know, lock another community in to a long commute consuming a lot of gasoline. But that's going to be the kind of decision that, you know, it's going to be made on a state-by-state basis. There are a lot of people, for instance, you know, including a group that advocates for more infrastructure spending that has as its leaders, you know, Governor Ed Rendell, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, a Republican from California, and Mayor Michael Bloomberg, an independent from New York. Groups like those are now pushing what they call fix it first, saying, you know, okay, there's all this money for roads and bridges, but rather than building, you know, new roads or widening roads that will expand capacity and, you know, eventually lead to more pollution and gridlock in their view, you know, why don't we fix what we have, bring it into a state of good repair so we don't have, you know, bridge collapses and potholes and highway problems. And that way, at least in their view, you're not making the problem worse.
Mm-hmm.
But this gets to one of the bigger, more interesting questions about this whole package, which is, you know, President Obama came to office calling for a set of principles, wanting to rethink the way the nation does certain things, and yet was faced with this immediate crisis where they decided that speed was, you know, of the most vital importance. And so as a result, a lot of the money, you know, is going out where they're not having the chance to really reinvent the policy. And by way of example, I mean, as a candidate, one of the things President Obama used to say is that he wanted to create a public infrastructure bank that would spend $60 billion over, I think, 10 years. And so by one measure, he's sort of exceeded his campaign promise. You know, this is going to be $100 to $120 billion. But by another measure, he's sort of falling short of it, because part of the idea of the bank was not just to find a way to fund it, but it was a way to really set, you know, national priorities, to figure out which projects have real merit. You know, how can we get big things done? Because if you just go through the current formulas and send a little bit to every corner of the country, you just won't have the money to get a few big things done and to move a new policy forward. And so clearly, you know, with the need for speed, they kind of threw out the public infrastructure bank part of this, and they're just going to send out the money the old way and hope for the best.
Right. Because there are other big things to be done, right? The banks, we got the automobile industry.
Right.
We've got one thing after another after another.
And they just want the money to go out as fast as possible, and so you can't reinvent the wheel in the distribution process and, uh-huh. and hope to have it happen fast. Huh. But a lot of people think, you know, wow, we're doing, you know, one of the bigger investments in public infrastructure in recent times, but we're not putting in the mechanisms to change the policy and to target it the way we want to target it.
Uh-huh. Thanks very much, Steve, for the call. Jerry is next from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good, Kathleen. Say, my question is I look at this, and then I don't understand why this works this way, but our Federal Reserve basically prints our money. And this money is the money we use to take and do everything in our economy and in our government. Congress used to print the money. Okay, why can't we print the money, pay off the national debt, use the interest to pay for programs, and never allow the government to borrow again? You know, we're like the parents who gave our child a credit card, and that credit card is taxpayers. We got to pay for it. We don't have any control over what's happening with it. I really don't see the difference between the Fed printing the money and then borrowing it back to the government. But if the government prints the money and pays off the debt and uses the interest?
It's a good question, and it may be beyond my ken, since, you know, I'll tell you I'm not the strongest fiscal monetary policy economist out there. I think the concerns always are that if you simply print the money, you know, eventually you devalue the money because there's more of it, and then, you know, that might lead to inflation, which has its own attendant host of problems. I think, in a nutshell, that's the problem. But
when I was straight out of high school in the 70s, you could buy a car for $3,000-$5,000.
Mm-hmm.
Today, buy a nice car today, you got to spend $30,000 or $40,000.
Right,
the inflation argument is crazy. All it is that we're paying a lot of interest to a lot of folks that
right.
we shouldn't have to for printing our money and using it.
But there's inflation, and there's inflation. There's the way that the cost of a car has gone up since the 70s, and the way the cost of houses have gone up since the 70s. And then there's what happens to countries like Weimar Germany when you need a wheelbarrow to get enough dollars to the bakery to buy a loaf of bread. You know, it's a matter of scale, I think.
That was a collapse of an economy.
What's that?
And I understand that happening. I remember reading out of my history books about that, people using a wheelbarrow for the money. But, I mean, what's the difference today? If you had to take $40,000 to buy a car, that's a wheelbarrow of money.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If you pay cash. So
that's true.
I mean, you know, okay.
Maybe if we invented the credit card, that spares us the wheelbarrows.
Thanks, Jerry.
All right, thank
you. Yeah, thanks for the call. Sue from Fox Valley. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I guess my frustration and disappointment with what has happened is related to the lack of a general mission or operating statement that is guiding us through this crisis,
mm-hmm.
meaning what is really our number one priority? I was really glad to hear Mr. Cooper finally casting making the difference, the distinction between propping up the banks, which really make everything go in our country, and, you know, providing Main Street stimulus, you know, that we would normally be affecting during a typical recession. It seems to me that question simply didn't get answered, that the congressional Democrats did put hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars into the stimulus package that were things that our society could do without until we find ourselves on stronger footing. As a taxpayer, someone very concerned about generational debt, this frustrates me greatly. What is it in our system that prevents us from creating a litmus test that can give us a moral compass with regard to what should be spent and what shouldn't be spent? In my mind, every $100,000 should have produced three jobs for a year, or $300,000 should have produced three jobs for, or I should say, three jobs for 3 years. It's easy to translate that to people going back to work.
All right, we need to hold you there. We only have about 15 seconds left, Michael.
Well, I mean, that's the big question here, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, the goal to some extent was just to get money flowing into the economy as quickly as possible. I mean, people call this a Keynesian plan. You know, John Maynard Keynes once said that, you know, you could get money into the economy by having people bury jars of money and dig them up again, you know, and keep what they have. Of course, what we want to do, you know, and what any sensible society wants to do is use the money on projects that will be useful and create a lasting good.
Yeah, burying the money, though, maybe a quarter or a couple dollars. Maybe I'll do that this year. Well, thanks for all your reporting. You do a great job, and thanks for helping us figure this all out.
Oh, thanks for having me, and thanks for all the great questions.
Michael Cooper, New York Times reporter. We thank him for his time. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour, and to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. And thanks for all of your calls. They're great, as Michael said. So many of our guests say the same thing. They're right. News is coming up, and we'll have a great hour ahead. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.